Welcome to Vikings Weekly Podcast. I'm James Serene. I am delighted to be joined by Brigadier General Michael Herzog, a Vicom fellow at the Washington Institute, former head of planning for the Israel Defense Forces and long-standing negotiator on behalf of Israel with the Palestinians, and probably the best guest I can have on today to talk about the US announcement that they're changing their policy vis-a-vis how they define Israeli settlements in the West Bank and saying they are not illegal. Welcome to the podcast, Mike. Could you give us your reaction to that announcement and how you interpreted it?
Yes. Pompeo's announcement basically takes the U.S. position back to where it was for many years until the Obama administration. Historically, the U.S. position on settlements until the Carter administration, including that administration, was that they are illegal from point of view of international law. But that position was changed during the Reagan administration in the early 80s, based on a legal opinion written by the well-known legal author Eugene Rostov then, claiming that settlements are not illegal from the perspective of international law, because essentially there was no internationally recognized sovereign in that area. So Israel, when it carries out settlement activities, does not, you know, take the land of that belongs or to any recognized sovereign. That was the U.S. position for many years, namely that it's not illegal, but they did say that it's an obstacle to peace from a political point of view. Namely, the discussion is not legal, the discussion is political. The Obama administration moved the dial somewhat back towards the illegality of settlement activities by stating that they are illegitimate. And now Pompeo is taking the U.S. back to U.S. position back to where it was. But he does not deny that it's a political problem. It has to be resolved politically. All he's saying is that let's not discuss it on legal basis, because there's no legal binding legal basis. Let's discuss it on political grounds. And that's where we've been anyway, because if we have peace negotiations, we'll have to come to agreement between the parties anyway. So it doesn't make that much of a difference, other than, you know, symbolically and in terms of what some people would like to do with that statement as a follow-up. But ultimately, if we are talking about the basis for a peace process in future, in any case, it should not be a legal one. It should be a political one, because it requires decision between agreement between both parties. There is a question that relates to this statement, which is, if the Israeli government decides to take concrete measures on the ground by applying Israeli sovereignty on certain territories, would the United States recognize that? I don't think that Pompeo's statement relates to that situation. So if we are faced with a new situation where Israel's government decides to apply the Israeli law and sovereignty in some of these areas, it's still an open question what would be the U.S. Response to such a measure, and how such a measure relates to the U.S. peace plan, which we've been waiting for nearly 3 years now.
I mean, one of the things I wanted to explore is that I'm sitting here in London in the UK, and there's always been this sort of gap between sort of official positions and then what's actually accepted in negotiations as sort of a potential solution. So, for instance, if we look at the UK position has always been very, very strict, where it says, you know, every piece of territory beyond the pre-67 lines, so that includes all of East Jerusalem, all of the West Bank, all of that is occupied territory, and every Israeli living there is a settler. They're in an illegal Israeli settlement, even if, you know, you have an anomaly where you have, you know, say somebody who is a Jewish family and they've lived in the old city of Jerusalem for generations. And then after 67, they go back to, say, their house that was taken over by maybe Jordanian soldiers between 48 and 67. And if they go back to that house, they're still considered by, you know, the UK government as illegal settlers. And illegally there under international law. And it's a very strict position. And I've discussed this with UK policymakers, and they sort of accept that, you know, there are historical sort of anomalies, and that also in the negotiations, there is sort of what we'd call in the UK kind of wriggle room, where you accept that, yes, those are the official positions. But actually, when you're talking about it, you start to talk about, OK, where are the big settlement blocks? What would actually stay part of Israel? What would then go to the Palestinians? So, in some ways, Pompeo's announcement, he's not saying that, you know, that isn't still the position. But I think what's interesting is he's moving out of that gap, and he's sort of saying, OK, that was the strict position. But he is moving almost to a sort of Israeli legal position where it's sort of settlements are not per se illegal, but we will look at every settlement on a case by case basis. So to what extent does that take the U.S. somewhere else? People talk a lot about the U.S. being an honest broker. Can it be a mediator? You've got the Palestinians criticizing it, the Jordanians. What do you think the impact is going to be among some of those partners and the international community?
You're absolutely right in suggesting that there is a gap between the official, you know, international position on the status of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the actual positions when it comes to actual either negotiations or actions on the ground. Officially, the Palestinian position and the position of, I would say, most of the international community is that any territory beyond the 67, 49, 67 lines is essentially Palestinian. Mm-hmm. Israel never accepted that position. Israel has always claimed that these are not occupied territories, but disputed territories, that we have legitimate claims over the land, which are carry no less weight than the other side, and we have to resolve it through political negotiations, not through legal deliberations. And essentially, that position was recognized in negotiation room. Because when people look at the map and see what's happening on the ground, and when we talk to them bilaterally or through a mediator, people understand that the situation on the ground is rather complex, and that Israel is not going to withdraw to the 67 lines, which are not internationally recognized borders. They are arbitrary armistice lines from 1949, where the armies of Israel and the Arab countries stopped fighting. They cannot serve as an actual basis, as a binding international border. That has been accepted, and because of that, we agreed throughout the years that the baseline for a territorial solution would be the reference point would be 67 lines, but there will be mutually agreed swaps because people understood that there are some Israeli security needs and legitimate claims and some, developments on the ground which have to be taken into consideration. And the same goes for other territories, like in Jerusalem. People understood, including Palestinians, that Israel has legitimate claims. I mean, many of them denied any Jewish connection to that land, but others accepted it. And so it's not, there was always a gap between the official position and the actual negotiating position, including of the Palestinians. And in the unofficial negotiations between Palestinians and Israeli, the so-called Geneva Accords, which are not official, the Palestinians recognize that Israel might accept one or two settlement blocks, and they recognize some Israeli demands and claims in Jerusalem. The situation there is much more nuanced. And one of the translations of this complexity was the fact that many U.S. administrations accepted the Israeli position that there should be a distinction between the settlement blocks, which are also which host most of the Israeli settlers and which are also important for Israel's security, and isolated settlements outside the blocks. That has not been the position of all administrations, but certainly most of them accepted it, if in a de facto way. And the same, I think, goes to some other international actors. Now, will the U.S. announcement that settlements are not illegal have any bearing on this? Remains to be seen, but I will draw your attention to the fact that since Trump's administration took office, there was never an issue for them about Israeli settlement activities inside or outside the blocks, to the extent that there were differences, they were dealt with privately, never publicly. You never heard any public criticism of Israeli activities. More likely, these were dealt with through a quiet mechanism between the governments. Again, this statement does not tell us what would be the U.S. position if Israel moves to annex part of the West Bank. That remains to be seen. It also has to be dealt with in the context of the U.S. peace plan. To what extent certain Israeli measures on the ground, including settlement activities, contradict the U.S. peace plan or comply with it. That we don't know until the plan is tabled.
I mean, I was going to ask a question about, you know, you've been in that negotiating room, you've had these discussions directly with Palestinian interlocutors, and I just wanted to, you know, clarify that it has been the case that the idea of settlement blocks staying within Israel has been accepted by Palestinians, but clearly not all of the settlement blocks, because, I mean, for our listeners, we should clarify that I think there is a perception that the settlement blocks kind of form a kind of easier line along the security barrier, but there are some settlement blocks that cut sort of deep into the West Bank.
There are three major settlement blocks, which are Gush Etzion, Maale Adumim, East of Jerusalem, and Ariel, and there are some small blocks, mini blocks. And in our negotiations with the Palestinians, it was always understood by both sides that they will accept the annexation of Gush Etzion to Israel and Maale Adumim to Israel in a future peace deal between us and them. They never accepted Ariel, which stretches relatively deep into the West Bank, nearly 20 kilometers. But they did accept Gush Etzion and Maale Adumim with perhaps a different delineation than the Israeli delineation. But the idea was accepted, and it was based on the idea of territorial swaps. And we had lengthy discussions about territorial swaps. Now, these three major settlement blocks host about 75, perhaps 80% of settlers, including, I would add to them, two huge ultra-Orthodox cities on the Green Line, on the delineation line between the West Bank and Israel. So taken together, most settlers reside there, which provided an opening for a solution whereby if you agree on territorial swaps, most of settlers don't have to move, but they can stay where they are. Again, the reality in the negotiating room was much more nuanced than the official position.
Yeah. And do you think this announcement is going to in any way change the perception of Israeli settlements and their status by other countries? Or do you think they're all just going to absolutely stick to where they are and nothing's going to change? Or do you think this does present a challenge for people to understand the nuances a bit more and to understand the gaps between what's been negotiated between the parties and what's the official kind of international diplomacy position? Do you think it's going to challenge any of that? Or do you think things will just stay the same?
I don't expect other international actors to follow the United States in this position. certainly not the major international actors, certainly not major European actors. But notwithstanding the question whether or not the legal debate, whether or not settlements are legal, in any case, it's been clear to everybody that the issue of settlements will have to be decided politically. And that the real discussion is in political terms and not in legal terms. And when it comes to political terms, we know the positions of the relevant actors. That will not change. So I don't expect that major actors will follow the United States, and they will continue to say probably that they see it as a challenge in both legal and political terms.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll ask you a difficult question. I mean, if we get to a point where an Israeli government starts annexing the Jordan Valley and saying they're going to apply whatever it means, Israeli sovereignty to Jewish settlements, do you feel that then makes any kind of deal much, much harder? Or do you think, again, it's all up for negotiation, it's all political, and a lot of this stuff isn't going to sort of, close the door on a deal in the future? How do you feel about that?
Obviously, both Palestinians and Arab actors view Israeli annexation, any part of the West Bank, in very negative terms. So certainly this is not going to be helpful to a peace initiative. And I suspect that it will also have a very negative impact on our relations with Jordan. We've seen that, not only the Palestinians. So I don't know what exactly the U.S. peace plan has in mind when it comes to the territorial solution, but notwithstanding that, it's very hard to see how such a move can help the atmosphere of peace negotiations.
So I was going to ask about the U.S. peace plan. I mean, we heard a lot about this. We thought it was going to be imminent, and then the government was never formed after the April election, and we haven't heard much about it since. I mean, you sort of have had some discussions with people involved in the U.S. peace plan. Do you think it's going to be published, or do you just think now, we're going to get into the 2020 election cycle and it's not going to happen? What's your feeling?
First, I don't expect it to be put forward until Israel has a functioning government. As you know, we have a political crisis. We may have two third elections in 1 year, which is unprecedented in Israel's history. And if that happens, then the whole thing will be pushed further to somewhere to probably mid-2020, maybe even beyond that. We are already in the midst of election year in the United States, and there's a big question whether or not the Trump administration will decide to put forward a peace plan in the height of election year, whether or not Trump's political base would support that is an open question. So I have my doubts whether we are going to see that plan in the near future. As I mentioned earlier, we've been waiting for that plan for nearly 3 years now, and the can has been pushed down the road repeatedly, and probably being pushed. If we do have a government in the next few weeks, probably the question will come up, but ultimately it's up to Trump and Trump alone to make that decision. And I believe, as I said, that his decision will be governed to a large extent by what his political base wants him to do. If they think that this plan, I'm talking mainly about the evangelicals and some others, if they think this plan goes too far as far as demands from Israel are concerned, they may push back against it. So that's an open question.
Let's move on to something even more complicated, which is the situation in Gaza. And I wanted to really get your analysis of what happened last week. With we had quite a unique scenario where we had a conflict in Gaza between Israel and a Gaza organization, but it wasn't Hamas. It was basically a straight fight between Israel and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The initial sort of spark for that conflict appeared to be the targeted killing of an Islamic Jihad leader, Baha Abu al-Atta. And then Hamas sat out that conflict and it sort of petered its way through. And I just wanted to get your sense of what that tells us about what's going on between Israel and Islamic Jihad, Israel and Hamas, and what's going to happen in the weeks ahead.
Yes, that was an accurate description. An eruption in Gaza was in the air for a long time, since Hamas started those marches on Israel's border every Friday a year and a half ago. We already had like 9 eruptions of several days of trading blows, including the dozens or hundreds of rockets. But this was different because, as you mentioned, it was between Israel and Jihad Islami, with Hamas staying out. Gaza has been long oscillating between a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel on one hand and potential escalation on the other hand. And we've been moving toward a ceasefire arrangement through the good mediation of Egypt and the UN Special Envoy, Nikolai Mladenov. But that move was faced with numerous challenges, including the lack of funds for a reconstruction in Gaza, very slow pace, and the fact that only Qatar was willing to carry that burden, and the rift between the PA and Hamas, and domestic pressure and so on. But the biggest challenge in the last few months was the fact that elements within the Jihad Islami organization, which is the second biggest organization in Gaza, with very close relations to Iran, they get Iranian funding and the weapons and some guidance from Iran and so on. There were elements in Jihad Islami in Gaza who acted in a rogue manner, took things in their own hand, and acted independent of Hamas and Hamas's policies of ceasefire. And the fact is, if you check statistically, almost all firing of rockets towards Israel in recent months were carried out by these elements, headed by Baha Abul Attar, who was the commander of the Northern Brigade of Jihad Islami, and perhaps the most important fellow in the Jihad Islami military structure in Gaza. And the firing was designed, occasional firing of rockets towards Israel without any, notice or any warning, was first designed to show independence of Hamas. Secondly, to kind of challenge the ceasefire arrangements which Hamas was negotiating indirectly with Israel. And Israelis also suspect that there was Iranian hand behind the scenes, because Iran wanted also to challenge Israel from Gaza, given the showdown between Israel and Iran in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and elsewhere. So, as I mentioned, all firing of rockets towards Israel in recent months were carried out by Jihad Islami, including in one noteworthy incident in the campaign, in the run-up to our last elections, when the prime minister was speaking in one of Israel's southern cities. They fired 2 rockets on that city and he was ushered away. So they became a big headache for everybody. And Hamas did not move strong enough to enforce the ceasefire on them. So there are several elements in which this round was different than the previous one. The first, that you had an Israeli initiative here. It wasn't just kind of tit for tat escalation, but it was an Israeli escalation to target this guy Baha Abul Attar. Part of the background to this initiative was the fact that Israel had intelligence that he was planning significant attacks on Israel, including with small armed drones and rockets and all that, and Israel wanted to thwart that. At the same time that he was targeted, there was also an attempted targeting of a senior Jihad Islami activist in Damascus, Akram al-Ajuri, was a deputy head of Jihad Islami and also head of their military wing. That attempt failed. He probably escaped, but nobody assumed responsibility, but it is widely attributed to Israel, and there's a kind of an implicit assumption that there were ties between Bahabul Attar and the military wing in Damascus, and that military wing was in close touch with Iran. So even if he did not get direct guidance from Iran to fire, he was probably acting in a way he thought was compatible with the Iranian policies. As you mentioned correctly, this round was characterized by blows being traded between Israel and Jihad Islami, with Hamas staying out. Mm-hmm. Jihad Islami was the one firing at Israel, with Hamas kind of abstaining, even though they share the same kind of war room of all the factions in Gaza and issued statements. But Hamas's silence in this case of not joining spoke volumes. Mm-hmm. And for as far as Israel is concerned, you also saw a change, because Israel targeted in this round only Jihad Islami and other organizations who participated targets, and did not go after any Hamas targets, signaling that if Hamas stays out, we are not going to go after them. And that was, I think, a very significant development. It tells you that as far as Hamas is concerned, they are more interested in a ceasefire arrangement than in escalation. They were probably concerned that Jihad Islami wants to drag them into escalation. In a deeper background, there's also talk about Palestinian elections today. And that, I think, also is a consideration for Hamas. We may ultimately not have elections, but they want to legitimize themselves in the domestic scene as well. This was really a very different round than the previous one. And Hamas, Jihad Islami, I think, were dealt a severe blow in this case. On the one hand, they fired over 450 rockets, about 450 rockets, and over 100 mortars, about 60% of them into open space, but 90% of their rockets fired on civilian populated areas were intercepted by Iron Dome. At the same time, Israel strikes dealt a severe blow to Jihad Islami. They lost significant numbers of senior military commanders. They lost infrastructure. I think they certainly lost in this case, which pushed them towards ceasefire after 2 days, essentially based on Israel's conditions. They are making statements about some gains, but Israel keeps its freedom of action. And on the other side, there was probably a commitment that during the Friday demonstrations, they will keep people away from the border fence and so on. What followed was a very strong domestic debate in Gaza between Jihad Islami and Hamas, inside Jihad Islami and inside Hamas. Between Jihad Islami and Hamas, there was a lot of criticism on Hamas for staying out. And yeah, you could see it in social media. In one noteworthy case, when one of the heads of Hamas, Mahmoud Zahar, headed a delegation which came to visit the mourning tent of Bahabul Attar's family, they were just driven away. They were not allowed to enter.
Yeah.
They later apologized, but that, I think, expressed deep feelings of anger at Hamas. Inside Jihad Islami, there were elements who were dissatisfied with the quick ceasefire and wanted to continue. And in any case, against Hamas's attempt to reach a long-term ceasefire with Israel, which resulted or expressed itself in the fact that even after a ceasefire was agreed upon, There are still occasional firing of rockets into Israel in the next day. But also inside Hamas, there were some elements who were dissatisfied with the decision not to join Jihad Islami. We've seen after the ceasefire on Saturday, the firing of two rockets towards Beersheba, deep inside Israel, this time by Hamas elements. And it's not clear that this was ordered by the Hamas leadership. Mm-hmm. So it may be, you know, another expression of dissatisfaction. There's a lot of debate internally today about this. So what next? I believe that this round, and the way it developed and the way it ended, removes one of the obstacles to a long-term ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, in which Hamas and Israel are interested. There are other challenges to be overcome, but this one at least was removed from now. So it gives enhanced chances for agreement on some kind of an arrangement between Israel and Hamas. How long this will hold depends on other factors as well, like investment in reconstruction, humanitarian solutions, economic solutions, the relations between the PA and Hamas, and so on. So you have, I would say, a concrete operational achievement for Israel, but strategically, we're basically in the same quagmire as relates to Gaza as we've been. And let's not forget that on the sidelines, we have Iran with the acute tensions between Iran and Israel. And Iran will do its utmost to get some elements inside Gaza, especially from Jihad Islami, to challenge a ceasefire with Israel and to challenge Israel at large.
But I mean, you talked a lot about the division between Islamic Jihad and Hamas, which is absolutely fascinating, and it's sort of about what it is they want to do. So the question is, do you want to try and run Gaza, or do you want to be the most violent, aggressive resistance, you know, armed military organization against Israel? But it's interesting that, yes, Hamas didn't take part last week, but it couldn't stop Islamic Jihad firing either. So there seems to be an issue there about either willingness or capability to stop those attacks, even when they don't want them to happen.
Yes, Hamas is in constant dilemma. On the one hand, the current leadership of Hamas, especially Yahya Sinwar, who appears more pragmatic than meets the eye and is open to ceasefire solutions. So on the one hand, they are the governing body of Gaza, and they feel responsibility to governing Gaza and providing ceasefire and solutions to the population. And that, of course, leads them to be not to be interested in any major escalation. At the same time, Hamas is what it calls itself a resistant group. They have their self-identity and the way they are perceived by others, and they don't want to give it up. So they are trying to maneuver in between these two poles. And the result was that while they themselves negotiated the ceasefire, they did not enforce it strongly enough on Jihad Islami. Mm-hmm. But when it came to the test of a major eruption with Israel, they did not join. And that, I think, was a very significant development. On the Israeli side, Israel has been constantly saying that as far as we are concerned, there's only one responsible address in Gaza. Good or bad, it is the responsible address, and that is Hamas. So Hamas carries responsibility for anything that's being carried out by anybody. And if anybody else fires, they have to enforce a ceasefire on them. But in this case, Israel deviated from that policy, and we'll have to see if it's a longer term or just one time, by going after Jihad Islami and not holding Hamas accountable for what Jihad Islami did. I think it was the right decision, but it's a very interesting and significant development.
Absolutely. Well, and we could talk about this for a lot longer, but I think we've covered a huge amount of ground. Michael Herzog, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to be joined now by David Markowski from Washington, D.C., who is a fellow at the Washington Institute. He's the director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy Project on Middle East Peace Process. And he has a book out at the moment called Be Strong and of Good Courage, which he's authored jointly with Dennis Ross, which is about how Israel's most important leaders have shaped its destiny. So the ideal person to talk to about this momentous announcement from the US administration saying that Israeli settlements will no longer be considered per se sort of illegal in international law. David, first off, what was your reaction to that announcement?
Well, there's two different issues, which is the substance of the announcement itself and the timing, you know, why now? So, I mean, in reality, all the peace plans that have come across all include some Israeli settlements as part of Israel. Even the Palestinian peace plans have included that. So I think that, you know, there is a need to draw a distinction between, you know, a legal opinion in 1978 and what really has, you know, shaped the actual peace plans themselves. And they have not been driven really by a legal opinion. They've been more driven by something more basic, which is where does demography meet with geography in the West Bank? So I tend to believe that where does demography and geography meet are ultimately going to be more important over time. And just as even the Palestinian proposals, let alone the American and the Israeli ones, have reflected that basic reality.
I was talking earlier with Michael Herzog about this idea of the gap between official positions, which countries sort of stick to, and that sort of how they view things and how they issue statements and the actual reality of what's happened in negotiations. So you've hinted at that there and talked about how there is some acceptance that some settlements will sort of stay where they are. But what do you think the impact of announcement like this has? I mean, we've seen the official statements from various people. What do you think the impact is on, you know, if there is an effort to try and get Israelis and Palestinians talking again, what kind of impact does this have?
Look, I think that there's probably no negotiations in the short term, neither between the U.S. and the Palestinians. And whether it's between Israel and the Palestinians, I think will be more dependent not on what Pompeo said yesterday, but based on whether Gantz emerges in this, you know, endless political interregnum period, if he emerges to have a position of influence, either as prime minister or close to that. And I think if there's a new opportunity there, I wouldn't be surprised if you would see some Israeli-Palestinian back and forth, regardless of the U.S. statement that is, you know, is bound to anger the Palestinians. But like I said, they have really cut off ties with the U.S. since December 2017, the time of the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem.
And Benjamin Netanyahu has been talking that, you know, this is now an opportunity that he's sort of doubling down on what he said during the election campaign about annexing the Jordan Valley. He's talked before about applying Israeli sovereignty to Israeli settlements. I mean, do you think that was the U.S. administration's intention to sort of give that kind of green light? Or do you think they sort of intended no such thing? How do you read it?
I don't know. Like, I want to be careful. When I don't know something, I say I don't know. So it's speculative. I wonder if this is kind of almost, you know, the opposite way of looking at it is a kind of almost a now or never moment, that it could be that the Middle Eastern brinkmanship that characterizes Israeli politics, you know, it goes down to the wire to the last second. You know, Gantz's mandate is up tomorrow, but there is a 21-day period of kind of a political overtime that the parties could still get together. And so I wonder if, you know, Netanyahu, U.S. Ambassador David Friedman, so I think it sticks in the throat of both of them, this idea that the settlements are viewed as being illegal when there was no prior sovereign, there was no Palestinian state before 67, and Jordanian control of the West Bank before 67 was not recognized. So I think you start there, that sticks in their throat, that this is hanging out there. And I tend to wonder if you know, Netanyahu's been talking to Friedman about this for months, and if he feels that, who knows after Wednesday if he's, you know, still the exclusive prime minister, or there's a power sharing arrangement with Gantz, in which case, you know, he would not get the full credit for this. And at the same time, you know, if Israel is heading to a third election, maybe it will have some value for Netanyahu, who always wants to accentuate the friendship that he has with President Trump. So whether it's that you're on the verge of a power sharing deal where you can no longer kind of extract full credit, or if you're heading into a new political election season, I tend to think that, you know, Netanyahu feels it probably helps him in both ways. I don't think it's going to be decisive in any way, but I tend to believe this was something that had been cooking for a while, and now you're getting to the point that if you don't do it now, you know, you won't get the credit for, you know, for trying to push it through.
And how has it been received in Washington and in the U.S. more broadly? Can you tell us a bit about what the reaction's been?
It's a little soon to know. I mean, the newspapers have played it up. It even made, you know, some of the network news, morning shows that usually do not want to get involved. But I don't know how much follow-up this is going to have. It's technical. You even talk to the journalists and, you know, they'll say, well, this is symbolic, but really all these peace plans were never based on these legal rulings in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if this is going to be a, you know, one day, 2 day story. I mean, I will say that, you know, having written this book with Dennis Ross on this topic, that, you know, this is really is at the heart of really of our book in many ways, is that we think that there needs to be a more differentiated conversation about settlements instead of lumping them all together. And that if there are settlements that are within the security barrier, and I have a website called Settlements and Solutions, that 87% of the people living over the green line, over the 67 borders, live in that 8% of the West Bank closest to Israeli urban areas inside the security barrier. While the other 13%, about 104,000 people, live outside the barrier and scattered in the rest of the 92%. And the point that Dennis Ross and I try to make in the book is we need a more differentiated conversation, because if the settlements that are inside the barrier, it's consistent with a two-state solution. But if you build outside the barrier, in the non-block settlements, that the net effect is that you could be shutting the door on the two states, because these populations will be so entangled. Shimon Peres had that famous statement that, like, from an egg you can make an omelet, but from an omelet you cannot make an egg. Yeah. That they'll be so entangled that you preclude the option even of two states in the future. I kind of think this is a key point for Gantz, when even if they do reach a power sharing arrangement with the Likud, how you handle this point of not building outside the blocks, I think is going to be important for Gantz. Not because he thinks a two-state solution is going to be implemented tomorrow, but because you don't want to take steps that preclude it ever happening. And that relates to Israel's identity and its character. It's an issue that's kind of gotten lost in the headlines because, you know, issues like Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, and Iran, of course, take up people's attention because they're very urgent. But Israel's identity and character are also important for the long term. And I think that is one of the foundational ideas of Gantz's blue and white party. So I think that the announcement is very much consistent with the book. The focus over it should really be a focus that's more differentiated. And that's really a key message of the book that Dennis Ross and I wrote.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important message. And I think, you know, what's happened, you know, over the last few hours as this story has played out, is that it sort of set the conversation alight, just simply because it was about settlements as one big blob. And there isn't any right. real discussion about right. which settlements and exactly. where. And here in the UK, there's a very simple position that the government has, where they basically say every single Israeli living over the pre-67 line is a settler and it's illegal in international law, and that goes the same if it's a if it's a little house in the old city of Jerusalem in the Jewish quarter, as it is to an isolated outpost all the way somewhere, you know, but right near Nablus.
I agree with you. But, you know, that even if you ask the Palestinians, if you say you take the East Jerusalem and you take the West Bank together, and you're talking about something close to 800,000 people, and you ask them, are these people going to disappear? And they say, of course not. And so, therefore, that leads even them to get to the issue of blocks. And so I think that that is a more reliable guide to me. The reality, the political reality, the demographic reality, where does demography meet geography in the West Bank, that will impact, you know, the contours of any territorial settlement more than, you know, some pronouncements from 1978.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, very interesting point you're making, and it's a really important thing to be trying to sort of, you know, put into this discussion. But I think, do you think that sometimes Israeli leaders, I mean, you've written this book about sort of Israeli leadership. I think there are some Israeli leaders that want to make that differentiation. And when they've been talking in sort of negotiations with the Palestinians, they get into the whole, you know, the blocks and the isolated outposts. But yet at the same time, you've got Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is basically saying, I want to imply Israeli sovereignty to everything. So he's also he's going against the very argument you're trying to make of
right. But the irony is, though, the irony is the guy's been prime minister for 13 years. Okay, so you got to believe in 13 years he's had a chance to actually implement something, and he only comes up with this idea of annexing the Jordan Valley and all these settlements, you know, 48 hours before an election. Isn't that a little convenient, a little suspicious that maybe he's trying to pull the rug out from parties to his right? And it worked for him in April, and it worked for him in September. So it's kind of has a, you know, rhetorically invoking it on the eve of an election has pulled the rug out of his more right-wing rival parties. But 13 years, he's had a chance. Yeah. To do any of this, and he hasn't done it. Is that a coincidence? I mean, I don't think so.
And also, I mean, if you look deeply at the numbers of the votes for the last election, the Likud lost votes. And so there is a sense that maybe people didn't believe that promise, or they just thought, you know, this doesn't impress me. Yeah. So that's very interesting. I mean, the other thing I was going to say about Gantz, which is interesting, you mentioned, is that I was at his first speech in January of this year, and he was quite clear with his language about the settlement. He talked about protecting the Jordan Valley, and he talked about the blocks. He didn't talk about anything in between. Exactly. Did you read that? Do you see that as his sort of the way
100%. I think that's crucial. I mean, I think if a party comes from nowhere to 35 seats the first time and to 33 seats the second time, yes, you can see it's a referendum on Netanyahu, but it's clear that the distinction is that people see in the centrist parties that Israel wants to separate, be able to have the ability to separate from the Palestinians in the West Bank, even if it cannot, as I say, it can't run the marathon with them. Even if you can't solve the conflict, it's not just about managing the conflict. You want to shrink the conflict. And therefore, I tend to think that and if Gantz is part of a power-sharing arrangement with Netanyahu's Likud, or certainly if he rules alone, you will see a different policy of not building outside the blocks. I don't think Israel's going to annex the Jordan Valley. I don't think they're going to annex all these settlements at all. Mm-hmm. So I think Gantz is a crucial figure, and therefore this is like being played out in real time. We'll know in the next 3 weeks if indeed he's successful or not, but clearly, his terms are going to get to the heart of our conversation today, which is, you know, we don't want to close the door on two states. We don't think it's possible today, but we don't want to shut the door on that. And therefore, our settlement policy has got to be consistent with at least the prospect of a two-state solution so that we can maintain its viability.
Thank you so much for joining us, David. That was a really good overview. And one thing I will say to our listeners, we will share on various outlets, Twitter and Facebook, the links to your excellent website, which I would recommend that our listeners look at, which is probably one of the best examinations of where the settlements are, where the populations are. It's a really serious piece of work. So thank you for all of that. And we will share the links to it. But David Makowski, thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.